You're listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I talked to Jen Hall, the social media and website coordinator of the MASIC Foundation, which supports women who have suffered serious injuries during childbirth. Jen suffered a third-degree tear after a forceps delivery in 2013 and shares her story of the birth, the consequences, and her work with MASIC. We talk about the Ockenden Report, the culture that contributes to severe birth injuries, and the implications for informed consent. If you want to support the important work of MASIC, do check out their website and follow them on social media. If you're a Bits of Me supporter, thank you so much. But now, Jen's story. Just start very briefly with your own experience back in 2013.
So I had a very long second stage of labour. I'd been pushing for 2 hours and I couldn't feel anything happening even though I was fully dilated. I'd been given an epidural at quite a late stage when I was about 8 centimetres, and this meant that it was turned up pretty high during the pushing stage, and I couldn't feel any sort of natural urge to push. The people around me were telling me to, you know, keep pushing, and I didn't have any of that sort of natural sensation.
So
I remember at that time the midwife sort of said to me, if you don't push this baby out, we're going to have to use forceps and you don't want that. It was kind of like a bit of a threat. So she said that, and then because I had the epidural in, they left me pushing for another hour. So it was like 3 hours in total. But as I still wasn't able to advance and the baby's heart rate was dropping, they said that they were going to have to use instruments. So there's a locum registrar came in and he tried first with the Ventouse, but this was unsuccessful. He tried a couple of times and still nothing was happening. So then I remember him saying that they were going to have to cut me and try using the forceps. I don't remember anything about, I couldn't feel the episiotomy cuts. I was just like, please get this baby out. And then, you know, I could remember this sort of like huge, because I was so numbed up with the epidural, there was actually no pain, but I can just remember this like huge, like forceful internal pulling sensation as he used the forceps. It sort of felt like such a deep feeling inside, like all my pelvic organs were being dragged down out of my body. Just remember that. Then the baby's cry, and I was told that my son had been delivered in one pull, so his head and body came all at once.
And how did you feel then?
I felt relieved. I remember feeling so relieved that he was finally out and actually thanking the registrar. And then another couple of doctors came into the room and kind of did the Apgar checks on my baby boy, and he was fine. And he did have quite large red marks on his cheeks from where the forceps had been placed around his head. But I remember sort of, you know, checking that he was okay, and, it was so good to know that all his checks were fine. I just felt relief, really, after that such a long second stage, you know, that he was out.
And what happened after that in terms of, how were you feeling, and what had happened to your body, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I thought everything was fine because he'd arrived, and I didn't really realise that I'd sustained any damage until the midwife came to the bedside and told me that I'd sustained a third degree tear and that I'd need to go to surgery to be stitched up. They couldn't do it in the delivery room. So she told me that, and then they handed me a consent form and told me that I needed to sign before they could repair. And I think really it was at that moment that I realised what had just happened. The consent form was really frightening. The consent was for the surgery, so it listed the long and short-term outcomes of the repair surgery. It was basically just like a huge disclaimer in case I was left with any of these things following the repair. And, you know, it was long. The list was very long and included a lot of things that I'd never thought of before or seen before, like anal incontinence, an inability to control wind, impaired bowel function, pelvic floor dysfunction, nerve damage, sexual dysfunction, all these horrendous things. And it was that moment that I realised something kind of seriously gone wrong. and that this wasn't just a normal birth. Even though I was in no pain at this point because I was so, you know, because of the epidural and anesthesia. So it was just kind of like reading those things in abstract, really.
Mm. And then I suppose, presumably you did sign because you don't really have a choice at that stage.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I did sign. And I think I was in shock after that. And I suppose just hoping that the repair went well and that I wouldn't have any of those things long term. But I don't think you can get your head around that when you've just delivered your first baby. You just, so many emotions.
Mm.
I think part of my brain just shut down, really.
So how did it go? You went in and had the operation.
Yeah, so I went down to the sort of surgical repair room. It was about a 3-hour delay, actually, after I'd given birth because they were waiting for a theatre to become free. I don't know how many stitches that I needed. I've still never been told that. I think I was in there for about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Wow.
I remember thinking I'd rather I was knocked out and I didn't kind of realise what they were doing. I think it was worse that I was fully, you know, that I was fully conscious and, you know, I'd got my legs in stirrups and there were like three people down at that end sort of talking about repairing me. That was really hard.
That is a long time to be in that situation and conscious of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really frightening, actually. And, you know, I was on my own and my mum, who was there with me, you know, during the delivery, had stayed up in the delivery room with the baby. So it was really frightening. But they did it and they said that it had been a successful repair. Though I do remember at one point the surgeon saying, I hope this repair will hold, which wasn't the most reassuring thing to hear.
Is that something you overheard or something he said to you?
Overheard. Yeah, he said it to like his assistant. So yeah, I remember returning to the delivery suite then and my mum was waiting with the baby. And by this point, it was like 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. So I'd delivered at about 10 o'clock at night. So by this time after the repair, it was 3-4 a.m. in the morning. I was absolutely exhausted.
Mm.
And that was when all the emotions kicked in. It was like, I just felt it was so surreal and terrifying what I'd just experienced. I think my body had gone into shock.
Yeah.
I'd had a postpartum hemorrhage before they repaired me. So I was feeling very weak. I'd had nothing to eat and I'd only had water to drink. I tried breastfeeding, but it was really clear that I was too poorly to feed. So the midwife on duty sort of made up a bottle for the baby.
Mm.
And yeah, I blanked out a lot of the rest of it. I was in hospital for another 5 days recovering. The midwives helped to sort of look after the baby at night because I was so poorly and he continued to be bottle fed. And then when I returned home, I was still in a lot of pain and very immobile.
Mm.
I think you have an idea of how those first few days with your baby will be, like a blissful time, and how it's supposed to be the happiest time of your life.
Yeah.
I just remember feeling so ill and like an overwhelming sense of not being able to cope.
And you were living on your own at this time, but your mother was helping you.
Yeah, so I was a single parent, so my mum was helping me. And it was really hard, you know, in that way, because I didn't have the support I didn't feel like I'd had. Again, it wasn't how I thought having a baby would be, to have my partner at my side and a kind of like an experience that we'd gone through together. I think it was worse to have gone through that alone.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you were diagnosed with postnatal depression then in the end, weren't you?
Yeah. I wasn't getting better. You know, emotionally, what happened to me was so difficult to cope with. I mean, I look back now and I realise that I didn't just have postnatal depression. You know, I was in shock and I was suffering from the grief of the breakdown of my relationship, as well as like acute trauma from the birth.
Mm.
You know, and I think it's really easy to say, oh, it's postnatal depression. But I think there was so much more to it than that because of what I experienced with that birth. And I couldn't really hide what I was suffering. I couldn't hide it from the midwife, from the health visitor. I just wasn't coping. And I think some of the reason that women hide this is because they fear being judged. And this is exactly what happened to me. You know, I spoke out that I felt that what had happened at the birth had really contributed to how I was feeling and not physically being able to get back on my feet.
Mm.
And it wasn't understood at all. And actually, you know, the concerns of the health visitor were then escalated to social services. And, you know, I found myself in a position where I felt that I was, the more I spoke out about the physical distress I was in, the more that I was going to be threatened with having my baby taken away, or, you know, that this was more than postnatal depression. This was something that was wrong with me.
Mm. So you weren't offered, nobody acknowledged the trauma that you'd been through. You weren't offered like any support in terms of dealing with what you'd been through.
No, it was recorded really as a normal birth. It was a, you know, it'd been a successful forceps delivery. Everything that I was experiencing was an exaggeration on my part, if you like, because I was still mourning the loss of my relationship. It was something inherent in me because I obviously had some sort of mental health disorder. You know, that was that was the narrative that I was surrounded with really at the time. Which obviously then just compounded my mood and my distress, you know, because I felt like I wasn't being listened to. And
yeah, of course,
you know, the pain that I was in, the problems that I was having, not being able to go to the toilet, and just feeling so ill and not able to get out of bed, you know, that was being dismissed and ignored.
But in the end then, you ended up in a mother and baby unit. What was that like?
They were fantastic in there. They were really supportive. Obviously very experienced with postnatal illness and postnatal depression. So very understanding and more experienced, you know, than the sort of local midwives and health visitors, really. I think it was really, they allowed me that space to bond with my son and be, you know, be a mum without pressure from people visiting the house and judging me and threatening me if I didn't recover as they felt that I should be. But I still feel that even though I was being treated in a specialist unit like that, that it was dealing with mums in crisis all the time, they didn't really seem to have an understanding of the effect of severe perineal injury and the trauma that inflicts on a woman. You know, how it affects you psychologically to sustain a third or fourth degree tear. So I was offered support with postnatal depression. I was given antidepressants. But I think it was always at the back of my mind that how was I going to cope with this new physical reality? You know, all those things that I'd read on the consent form. If that was in my future, I didn't really want my future.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a single mom having to cope with all those things. That was always at the back of my mind, and I still couldn't really talk about that with anybody. And obviously, you know, I was 33, so whilst it felt maybe a bit, the narrative that it was selfish to be thinking about those things, I was thinking about how will I have a sexual relationship again? How would a new partner cope with me being in my 30s and possibly incontinent? Or, you know, with pelvic organ prolapse. These are horrible things that I didn't really know about, but the more I read about it, I associated with older women and, you know, something that you didn't have to think about in your 30s. You know, there was never any, it was all about getting me better and being well enough to be a mum, but there wasn't a lot that was considered beyond that. You know, my life before becoming a mum, there were things that were important to me, like being able to run. I was a keen runner.
Yeah.
And I'd like to swim and go to the gym. I was quite an active person, and all that was mixed in with my feelings as well. Like, you know, I knew that, you know, this perineal trauma was serious. I just instinctively felt like, how am I going to jog up and down and run and do those things that I used to enjoy? I just knew that even though it had been repaired, that was going to be really difficult. And I just kind of feared, you know, this horrible body that I'd have to live with the rest of my life. That's how it felt.
So a few years later, you came across the work of MASIC. Do you want to tell me a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, so it was 3 years post-birth that I was introduced to MASIC. I tried to sort of pull my life together and, you know, after that horrible post-birth period and, you know, being a single mum to a young active toddler, it was really difficult. You know, over those sort of 3 years post-birth, I'd noticed that the physical symptoms were actually getting worse rather than getting easier. So I couldn't really stand for any period of time or bend or lift. I'd had chronic pudendal nerve pain, which had been caused by the forceps delivery. So I'd had to stop exercising. And I've been diagnosed with erectocele, so I was noticing it was getting harder and harder to kind of go to the toilet normally.
So erectocele, just to clarify, that's a type of prolapse.
Yeah, it's a prolapse of the back wall of the vagina. It sort of meant that I wasn't really able to empty my bowel properly or normally. And I was experiencing some leakage afterwards as well. So I hated having to wear a pad every day, and kind of noticing like an increasing amount of vaginal laxity and just all these sort of horrible worrying things. So I'd been to see numerous consultants and referred myself to specialist pelvic floor units in London and Oxford. But I kept being told that there was nothing they could do except surgery to try and repair that back wall. But this was likely to make the nerve pain worse. So it wasn't necessarily going to resolve all the problems that I was experiencing.
Yeah.
So I found Mazik, really, at this point, still looking for answers and some help to cope with dealing all this with it emotionally. I found the charity through a solicitor at Lee Day. I'd been to talk to her about whether there was a medical negligence case. But because it was longer than 2 years after the birth, and because it was difficult to sort of pinpoint an individual case of negligence, I couldn't bring a legal case.
Okay.
So she suggested that I attend Mazik's launch event, which is going to be in conjunction with Lee Day at the Royal College of Medicine. And she just said, you know, you might find support from other women who'd been through the same thing and perhaps learn some more about the consequences of birth injury from the medical professionals who would be speaking that day. And it really was the best thing that I could have done. It was so emotional for me that day to hear other women sort of telling their stories, really similar stories to mine, and to actually hear it acknowledged from medical professionals that these injuries are life-changing and quite devastating, and that more must be done to prevent them. I think it really helped me to feel less alone, and kind of all the feelings that I'd held inside for those 3 years, all the trauma that I'd experienced and all the times that I'd been told it was in my head. Kind of like this bad mother narrative that I should be thinking of my child and not thinking of myself and my body. All those feelings kind of finally had a place where I could safely express them, I think.
And so you decided to get involved?
Yeah. I knew I wanted to be involved with a charity, and I kept in touch with the founder, Professor Keith Lee, and he invited me to 2 further education days. And then in 2018, I volunteered to sort of start looking after the charity Twitter feed, and I'd become very interested in the politics of childbirth and instrumental delivery, and I kind of felt that Mazik had to be online and involved in these debates. So my role in social media for the charity has grown, and I realised that there's so many women out there wanting to talk about these issues and their experiences. And in sort of last year, whilst I've been on furlough, I started working for Mazik full time, and sort of taking us onto Instagram and Facebook, and we're currently nearing completion on a brand new website and rebrand for the charity that's going to be very much women led rather than purely for educating the doctors, and we hope that this issue is going to be taken more into the mainstream now. The pandemic kind of forced us online, but it's actually been the best thing that could have happened for us as a charity. I mean, as you know, there's a passionate community of women online now talking more openly about the physical and emotional toll of childbirth. And I so wish that this had been the case when I sustained my injury 8 years ago, because I know how much it would have helped me to understand what had just happened and cope with it emotionally, I think.
So in the work that you do with Mazik, what are the kinds of stories that you come across from other women?
Well, women tend to find Mazik when they've been struggling for quite a while with very difficult symptoms, and they haven't found a lot of help from the NHS. A lot of time they're looking for support from other women who've been through this. A lot of time they're looking for answers about the right course of treatment and how to cope with their symptoms. A lot of our original advocates came into the charity after they'd undertaken medical negligence cases. Professor Keith Lee had kind of been involved on the medical legal side, and then brought the women together to support each other. And a lot of those cases were missed third and fourth degree tears, so they'd been wrongly classified as second degree or missed altogether.
Okay.
You know, the women had been sent home obviously without adequate surgical repair, and then all the problems that came after that.
Mm.
I think the most important aspect of the work we're doing at the moment is letting women talk about the social, psychological and emotional impact of these birth injuries. You know, what's happened in their lives after sustaining these injuries, and they're left to cope with the fallout.
Mm.
You know, we really need to talk about this. Sort of relationship breakdowns, family relationships tested to the extreme, problems bonding with their child, suicidal thoughts, a loss of identity, fear of the future. You know, and a big thing is just this massive loss of dignity that nobody should have to deal with in their 20s and 30s and 40s when you've just had a child.
Yeah. And you did a survey earlier this year, am I right?
Yeah.
About
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we undertook a survey at the beginning of the year to assess the impact of like this type of injury on a mother's emotional well-being and the impact on the mother-baby bond. And it's very, very sad statistics to come out of it, but it's really important that we put them out there. You know, so like 85% of women said that it impacted on their physical and emotional relationship with their child.
Mm.
77% were affected by traumatic memories of the birth. 50% said they were unable to do normal activities with their child, you know, kind of like playgroups, school run, physical activity. 55% said they were embarrassed by being unable to control their bowel function. But most shocking for me is when, you know, we have 48% of women saying that they doubted their ability to mother because of this type of injury.
Yeah.
And 30% said they wondered whether their child would be better off without them.
Mm.
And I think that really cuts to the heart of the impact of this type of injury on how you feel as a mother, your experience of motherhood, and
yeah.
and just how almost impossible it makes, you know, those early years. And we need to get these statistics out there. You know, the most important thing we can do as a charity is try and get society as a whole to acknowledge the existence and impact of these injuries, because, you know, shame, denial and stigma play a huge part in women delaying seeking treatment and also exacerbating that mental health decline, I think.
Mm. Will we talk a little bit about the narratives around C-sections? Because this is something that that's very closely related to all the stuff that we've talked about so far.
Yeah, there's been a massive drive over the last 10 years, I think, in the NHS to reduce C-section rates. I think the pressure has come from numerous sources, maternity budgets being cut, particularly during the austerity years. Vaginal deliveries are about £700 cheaper than a planned C-section.
Mm.
I think there's been pressure from the natural birth community, and sometimes places like the NCT, and from a certain section of midwives to kind of reduce medical interventions during birth.
Mm.
And I think there's an element of a kind of underlying misogynistic attitude that all women should be birthing vaginally, and why are they asking for C-sections, and what's happened to all these women that are suddenly too posh to push?
Yeah.
You know, that phrase was everywhere in the media at one point. And I think within this climate, maternity units were just under a huge amount of pressure, and they still are, I think, to keep C-section rates low.
Mm.
But the problem is a vaginal birth, you know, if that's ended in forceps and a serious injury to mum, is seen as a good outcome because a C-section has been avoided, and, you know, I question the logic of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because nobody talks about the fact that whilst a vaginal birth might be cheaper at the outset, a preferable option on paper, if you like, if you take into account the cost to the NHS of treating a woman for prolapse, incontinence, all these lifelong outcomes when a vaginal birth goes wrong, or indeed, you know, the millions of pounds paid out in compensation when some of these birth injury claims are successfully taken to court, then, you know, those savings look a little naive, don't they?
Yeah. That's if you're even going to talk about it in financial terms, which obviously happens, yeah. But I mean, that's only the financial side of it. And obviously, as you've already outlined, there is so much more to it than that.
Yeah.
There was the Ockenden report that came out last year, looking at C-section rates and outcomes for mothers and babies at the Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and maybe summarise the conclusions?
Yeah, I think the Ockenden report, which came out in December last year, highlights what happens, the really terrible outcome for women and babies when there's this drive to keep C-section rates low. Some listeners may already be aware that this report was commissioned after dogged campaigning from those families who suffered harm as a result of their maternity care at the trust. Families told of their experiences of pregnancies ending with stillbirth, newborn brain damage, and the deaths of both babies and mothers. Mm. So following a review of 250 cases, the report states the need to urgently implement changes to improve the safety of maternity services at the Shrewsbury and Telford Trust and in maternity services across England.
Yeah.
I've just taken a quote from the report here, because I think it sort of highlights what we're talking about. It says, it's notable for the period of the review that the C-section rate at Shrewsbury and Telford was consistently 8 to 12% below the England average. The review team have the clear impression that there was a culture within Shrewsbury and Telford to keep C-section rates low because this was perceived as the essence of good maternity care. Overall, there didn't seem to be a consideration of whether this culture contributed to unnecessary harm. So here we can see quite clearly that the link between this pressure and trusts to keep C-section rates low and serious avoidable harm to mothers and babies.
So in your opinion, if we're looking at everything that you've said so far, what are the implications of all of this for informed consent in childbirth?
I feel that if the statistics from the last 10 years show an increase in instrumental deliveries and severe tearing, then women have a right to know, before they go into labour, what the risks of this type of delivery are, and they should be able to make an informed choice about whether that's right for them.
Mm.
Some women might read all the data around C-sections and instrumental deliveries and still want to have a vaginal birth because they believe that's what's right for them and their unborn child, and it's a risk that they're prepared to take. Other women may look at that information and quite justifiably feel that it isn't a risk for their body and their future health that they're prepared to take.
Mm.
I think it comes down to a woman's choice, and at the moment that's being disregarded. I remember feeling quite instinctively that a vaginal birth would be risky for me. I'm 5'2" and I was 7 stone when I fell pregnant. I'd always wanted a C-section if I ever gave birth, and that was actually without knowing anything about forceps and the risks,
yeah,
and how brutal they can be. The fact that that choice was denied me and then I went on to suffer severe damage shows how little women are listened to when it comes to decisions around their own bodies.
Mm.
I just think it's unacceptable that women don't know these risks before they give birth.
Yeah. I think it's important to make a distinction here to clarify that we're talking about a right to information and a right to have a C-section if you feel that that's what you want and need, and not to say that we should be pushing C-sections on people. I know there might be people listening who are thinking, oh, you know, C-sections aren't great, you shouldn't go for it just for the sake of it. What would you say to somebody who's kind of wondering whether that's what you're doing and if you're just pro C-sections?
I think we need to look at the kind of rhetoric that we are exposed to around vaginal birth versus C-section. And I kind of see it as similar to the abortion debate and kind of the narratives that women are exposed to there. You know, you're made to feel like you don't have a right to choose what happens to your own body, but everybody else is allowed an opinion on that.
Yeah.
You know, the unborn baby comes first, and that's right, but the woman's body is also more than just a mere vessel to deliver that child. You know, a woman has a life after that baby's born too, and has to live in that body for the rest of her life. And I think, you know, we're in danger of disregarding the potential physical, psychological and traumatic consequences for a woman.
Mm.
You know, if we don't talk honestly about what can happen when vaginal birth goes wrong, as you say, because it's important to make that distinction.
Mm.
I'm not advocating for C-sections all round. I'm advocating for choice, and every woman is entitled to choose what happens to her body and to safeguard her future mental and physical health.
Yeah.
I don't think it's controversial to say that, and I definitely don't have an issue with vaginal births. I think I have a problem with the secrecy and denial that goes on with forceps and instrumental delivery and these terrible outcomes when vaginal birth ends in a third or fourth degree tear. Mm. Support women to have a safe vaginal birth, continuity of care, less medicalised birthing environments, you know, equip women with the knowledge of their own bodies. you know, many medical I agree that many medical interventions take power away from the woman and into the hands of those delivering the baby. So I think this is all about information.
Yeah.
You know, I think too many women sort of, I think they trust that they will be given the right care in hospital and that it's safe for them and their baby. And in the majority of cases it is. But we're also being massively disempowered and kind of trusting to hand our body over to a system that's at times very under-resourced and still quite medically paternalistic.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues around talking about these types of injuries, and I think one of the reasons why we're made to feel as though we shouldn't talk about these injuries, is the lack of appropriate surgical solutions and different treatment options when things do go wrong, because it becomes more scary, obviously, if we're talking about these risks and then you're just left hanging because there's nothing there to help you and support you. Are you hopeful that the development is going in the right direction? And do you think that the experience of birth injuries will be very different in, I don't know, 10 years' time?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, maternal injury is shamed and silenced because those who do see the consequences, whether that's the woman herself and her family or the medical professionals trying to treat these injuries, know that there isn't a cure. Who finds it easy to talk about bowel incontinence and sexual dysfunction?
Yeah.
You know, there are some amazing medical professionals who we work with at MASIC who are very concerned about the issue and see that really it's about prevention rather than a cure, I think. You know, many of our trustees are involved with the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists OAC Care Bundle project. And this is a package that they've put together which aims to reduce the rate of third and fourth degree tears. They offer better antenatal information about risks so that women are told those risks that we've talked about. They suggest more hands-on perineal protection at birth, so that if there needs to be an episiotomy, that won't then extend into a third or fourth degree tear.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, like hands-on or a warm compress used on the perineum. And also educating midwives on the better detection of anal sphincter tears if they do happen. So the bundle suggests that, you know, every woman should have a rectal examination post-birth to make sure there isn't a missed third or fourth degree tear. So packages like that would really help with prevention. And also our education chair has done research on risk factors for severe tearing and pelvic organ prolapse, and he's looked at data like around maternal height, age and weight, and has produced a screening system that would allow women who are most at risk to be identified antenatally. So if you're 5'2" and under, if this is your first baby, if you're age 35 or over, or your BMI is 30 or over, you know, your risk increases significantly. So if all women were screened like this, you know, women who scored more highly could then be offered a planned C-section, or at least be properly informed of the risks. Yeah. And then make their own, you know, make their own choice about whether they still want to go ahead with a vaginal birth. They're really positive steps, but you won't believe how hard it is to get these changes implemented in the NHS. You know, there's a lack of coordinated standardised training across every trust, so it's a bit of a postcode lottery. As we know, there's also chronic understaffing on maternity wards, and I think there is that resistance, like you say, to acknowledging that these problems exist. And I think I don't want to be completely negative about sort of treatments when this does happen. I think there will be better treatments for birth injuries down the line. The recent pelvic mesh scandal shows that even when new treatments are offered, they can be shrouded in the same lack of understanding of women's bodies and a lack of long-term research when it comes to women's health.
Yeah.
So, you know, the mesh treatments for prolapse have now been paused, and we're back to traditional surgical treatments or conservative measures like physiotherapy to help women manage their symptoms. I'm hopeful that there'll be some innovations in like stem cell research, which would enable natural tissue to be grown and then implanted to support the vaginal walls instead of those synthetic materials that were used for the mesh. And I'd really like to see some proper investment in this kind of research. We do also, we're going to list on the new website some really excellent physios and consultants. If you know, if there are any listeners out there just at that point where they're needing treatment and advice, I think women's health physios are like the angels of the birth injury community. They really are.
They absolutely are, yeah.
Yeah. And I just couldn't recommend getting to see one highly enough. You know, even if you have to pay for a few sessions, it's so worth the investment if you're struggling. It was a physio who treated like my pudendal neuralgia symptoms.
Mm.
She did internal scar massage and muscle release work, as well as offering, you know, very effective pelvic floor strengthening advice. And my pudendal neuralgia is a lot less bothersome than it was.
Yeah.
You know, I have far fewer flare-ups, and she was so hard to find. I think there's about 6 physios in the UK who do the internal scar release and,
yeah,
you know, that work. But they are being trained all the time, and there's some brilliant physios on Instagram.
Mm.
And I'm just so grateful to her and all the other amazing pelvic health physios that we work with, really. But I do really think that the conversation should be about prevention. You know, listen to women, tell them about the risks, give them an honest choice between C-section and vaginal birth, and offer maternity care that isn't influenced by targets and quotas and a dismissal of women's bodies post-birth, and we'd surely see a reduction in birth injuries and happier mums and babies.
Hmm. That was Jen Hall on Bits of Me. I'm putting all the basic links and information in the show notes, where you'll also find links to the Bits of Me socials. You can also support the podcast by sharing this episode, reviewing it on Apple Podcasts, subscribing or becoming a patron at patreon.com/bitsofme. If you've already signed up, thanks a million. Bits of Me is back next week, but for now, thanks for listening.